Then the second seal, Revelation 6, verses 3 and 4. This covered from 180 to 312 A.D. And when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come." And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given to him a great sword. Now, you notice the complete change here. This is not a war of conquest with a bow to strike enemies at a distance. With a sword, you can only hit a man who is substantially within arm's reach. This was fighting at home to take peace from the earth. Now, the prophetic world means no more than the area occupied by the empires of the Babylonian succession of empires. For example, Luke 2, verse 1. And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. The word translated world there is the Greek word oikumene, literally inhabited, and with an additional connotation of civilized. Now, quite obviously, Caesar Augustus couldn't order the taxing of China or the Inca Empire in Peru or any of those things. The world of Bible prophecy is the nations surrounding the Mediterranean Sea and extending eastward into Western Asia. So, take peace from the Roman world, and that they should kill one another, internal warfare. This period began with the reign of the Emperor Commodus, 180 to 192 A.D. He's one of the bloodiest and most licentious tyrants in history. The next 2 years, 192-193, saw two emperors reign with nothing accomplished for either of them. Then followed by Septimius Severus, who reigned from 193 to 211. Caracalla, 211 to 217 A.D., was noted for his extreme brutality. Heliogabalus, 218 to 222 A.D., noted only for his debauchery. Alexander Severus, 222 to 235, a fairly able ruler. Then there was a period of chaos. There were 12 emperors in the next 33 years, each one of them put in office by military force by a Roman army that decided they'd make him their general, the emperor. Nearly all of them assassinated by soldiers in order that they could replace him with someone else. Claudius, who ruled 268 to 270. Then Aurelian, 270 to 275. Not so much of an administrator, but he was an able general who held back for a time the encroachments of the so-called barbarians, the people of the Scythian Israel tribes who were moving into the Roman Empire. In the 9 years, 275 to 284, there were six completely unimportant emperors. Then Diocletian, 284 to 305 A.D. He was an able administrator, made many reforms, but with a huge increase in bureaucracy and expense to the taxpayers. And also, the last terrible persecution of Christians came under Diocletian. Diocletian abdicated in 305 A.D., leaving total chaos, civil war, multiple civil wars, because every military leader who could get much of an army to back him was trying to seize the throne. And this lasted from 305 to 312, 313, when Constantine, through military power, took the throne. And you remember in 312 A.D. he issued his proclamation of toleration for the Christian Church. So the total period of this second seal, when you had civil war in Rome, was 180 to 312 A.D. Then we come to the third seal, covering 212 to perhaps 400 A.D. Revelation 6, verses 5 and 6. And when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come." And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures say, "A measure of wheat for a denarius, and three measures of barley for a denarius, and see that thou hurt not the oil and the wine." Your King James Version, in one of its most ridiculous mistranslation, says a measure of wheat for a penny, but it's the Roman coin, the denarius. Now you note that the rider on this horse had no crown and no weapon, so he was not an emperor. This measure, a kinex, was equal to just a trifle over a quart. The denarius, the coin with which you could buy a quart of wheat, would equal possibly 22 to 24 cents in today's money. It was a day's wage for a common laborer. You remember in one of Jesus Christ's parables, he told about the farmer who employed workmen by the day and promised each one his penny, the King James Version says, but a denarius, and even those hired for the last hour got the same denarius wage. It was the common wage of a laborer. Now that phrase, "and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine," doesn't make good sense, does it? And whenever you run into that, you know you have a problem in this translation again. It's also translatable, "see that thou be not unjust regarding the oil and the wine." Now that will begin to make sense once we know what they're talking about. The black horse, of course, symbolized depression and gloom. The balanced scale that the rider carried was a common Roman symbol for two things: one, justice, and the other, commerce. You remember that while coined money had come into pretty general use, it was in by no means universal use. And not only did they, with the scale, weigh out the weight of many commodities to be sold, but also a good deal of the purchasing was done with bars of gold or silver bullion, which had to be weighed to find out the weight from which you could calculate the worth. Now, taxes of the Roman Empire could be paid either in money or in an equal value of produce, such as wheat, oil, and wine. Now you had to be able to value the produce properly in terms of money so that the tax collectors would not unjustly collect too much for their own graft. So here was a definite denarius for a quart of wheat or for three quarts of barley, and with apparently some fluctuation in value of the oil and the wine, but to be fair and just in collecting taxes in oil and wine. In 212 A.D., the Emperor Caracalla, in what looked on the surface like a move of generosity, conferred Roman citizenship upon all free men living in the Roman Empire. Well, anytime you are told that any act of truth and generosity was practiced by one of the Roman emperors, you don't believe it. Of course, all people living in Rome paid a tax. But there was an additional tax collected from those who were Roman citizens. Now, up until that time, Roman citizenship was a jealously guarded privilege. You remember when Paul was arrested on one occasion, the centurion in charge of the soldiers had ordered that he be flogged. Beat him to make him tell what he had done, confess to something. And Paul said, are you going to flog a Roman citizen before he's been tried and condemned? And that got the centurion quite scared. He'd have been in difficulty if he had done that. Because while Rome was brutal, nevertheless she had her rules, and one of her own soldiers or officers who broke those rules would be treated with the same brutality anybody else got. So, the centurion said, I'm a Roman citizen too, but it cost me a great sum of money to buy Roman citizenship. Paul said, I was born a citizen. Well, Caracalla then made all free men in the Roman Empire citizens in order to make more people pay more taxes. From the death of Constantine, 337 AD, there was a period of civil war until 351, when finally one emperor got control again and the empire was split in two. The easterly half governed from Constantinople, formerly Byzantium, and the western half governed in the city of Rome. That was 379 AD. Well, the Roman taxes had always been heavy. You remember how bitter the people were in Judea about having to pay taxes to Rome, and how they hated the tax collectors, the publicans. Well, shortly after this, from about 395 or so, the combination of excessive taxes and the barbarian invasions that were biting deep into the empire ruined first the provinces, the outlying provinces of Rome, and finally Rome itself. Rome was no longer able to defend the provinces, so the so-called barbarians, who were the people of Israel, having gotten around the east end of the Black Sea, began moving up into the Danube Valley and westwardly heading toward the head of the Adriatic Sea and the Italian peninsula itself. One after another was lost to Rome as the so-called barbarians, the Israelites, took them over. And with a smaller base from which to draw taxes, the Italian peninsula, of course, was taxed even more heavily. The burden of taxes was so great that it wasn't much use trying to farm. You remember that you had the steps in the downfall of Rome. First, the burden of taxes was so great that the little individual peasant farmers had to give up and quit. They came to the city to become a landless city rabble that was the eventual downfall of Rome. Their lands were taken over by some of the big, wealthy people who, just as you have today, combined them into enormous farms, but the burden of taxation became so great that even they were not able to keep operating, and so they abandoned them. So that even in Italy, you had great areas formerly farmed and productive, now abandoned and going back to weeds. The power of the empire was breaking down after the time of Constantine. Now, meantime, the power of the church was gradually building up from the time that Constantine made it the state religion. So, starting, you might say, from 212 AD as a definable date when citizenship was conferred as a burden upon all the free men, you had going on to about 400 AD this period of increasingly hard times and increasingly heavy taxation bringing about financial ruin. There is, of course, an awful lot more to the book we're going to have to take up later. I haven't completed my studies to my own satisfaction on the rest of it, and I don't intend to go off the deep end about this particular book, I can assure you. I don't on any of them, and especially this one. So we'll go on with the opening of the rest of these seals in the next meeting. Christian Church. Now Constantine had established the new capital of the empire at Constantinople, very rarely visited Rome, and the emperors after him followed that. So the city of Rome itself, without being formally disavowed particularly, sank to the actual status of a mere provincial capital like Alexandria. After the division of the empire in 395 A.D., so you had one emperor ruling the eastern half of the Roman Empire from Constantinople, and one ruling the European and North African parts, the Western Roman Empire rarely ruled from the city of Rome. Usually the cities of Ravenna or Milan were the official capital. So you can see how the Roman sun had lost its light. Now the absence of the emperor from Rome left no one else to whom popular support could rally particularly, except the church. And the growing power of the Bishop of Rome as Pope of the church dates from this period, because with other power abdicated, somebody had to take over and keep order. In this History of Nations, Volume 4, page 131, it says, "In the absence of the emperors from Rome, the position of the bishop of that city had become one of no mean secular importance. It conferred wealth and splendor, attracted the devotion of women of the highest rank, and raised its fortunate holder to the pinnacle of fashion as well as of luxury. Accordingly, it became the object of contentious rivalry and was sought for with all the artifice and violence which had formerly disgraced the competitions of the consulship. The episcopal chair of Rome was now indeed a prize worth contending for by any ambitious man." Well, as I said, the Emperor Gratian, 375 A.D., refused the pagan title of Pontifex Maximus, and Gratian ordered the removal of the altar and the idol of the goddess of victory from the Senate house. Now, all through Constantine's time, here in the house of the Roman Senate stood this pagan idol of victory with the altar, and the senators made their sacrifices on this altar of victory, and Constantine himself took part in it periodically. But now Gratian was making a clean sweep of it. There was a bitter contest over that. Paganism was still strong enough to make quite a fight, but an unsuccessful one. So the pagan priests and nobility, the stars, fell to earth. The Roman sun lost its power. The moon, possibly symbolic of the emperor himself, because remember, the western part of Rome, overrun now by these invading so-called barbarian tribes, it was losing its power and its prestige rapidly. In fact, from the death of the emperor Gratian in 383 A.D., the military conqueror often disdained to take for himself the title of emperor. He would put some puppet in power as emperor while the conquering general himself, who exercised the real power, didn't bother taking the title. Some of them, for example, merely adopted the title patrician. Well, from this time on, the breakdown of the whole Roman civilization was complete. You find no example of men of greatness contending for power in there. You had a little group of treacherous, violent politicians contending for power, trying to get what they could by violence and what they couldn't by violence to gain by treachery. It was a period of completely ignoble men, and only the invading Goths showed truthfulness, fidelity, and good character. A mixed horde of these Germanic tribes, the Suevi, Alemanni, Vandals, and Alans, invaded Italy in 406 A.D. and got as far as the city of Florence before they were defeated and turned back. But they went on through Gaul into Spain, and those provinces were very quickly lost to the Roman Empire. Rome had no more control over either Gaul or Spain. The Visigoths, under Alaric, besieged Rome in 408 A.D. In fact, they got to the gates of the city and were finally bought off by an enormous ransom paid to them. In 409 A.D., Alaric returned with his Visigoths and blockaded Rome, which surrendered. Alaric appointed as emperor one of his own officers, Attalus. In 410 A.D., Alaric returned, captured Rome, and allowed his soldiers 6 days to pillage the city. Now, it's worthy of note that the Christian churches were respected as places of sanctuary. He gave orders to all his men that no Christians were to be bothered, interfered with in any way. They couldn't be plundered or killed. And those who gathered for safety in the Christian churches were not molested in any way. Alaric then went on to plunder the rest of central and south Italy. He then withdrew his forces, crossed through southern Gaul and into Spain and Portugal, and the Visigoths set up a kingdom in southern Gaul and in Spain and Portugal. And from then on, allow them to perhaps 425 A.D. to get over there. From then on, the Visigoths were the dominant people in Spain and Portugal until 711 A.D., when the Moorish conquest began. Now, most of the Romans saw this series of terrific defeats and plunderings as God's judgment on paganism. So the pagan temples were turned into Christian churches, and the Catholic Church simply took over the existing paganism. They took over the old pagan temples and made them churches. The idols in them were now said to be statues of St. Peter or St. somebody else, and the congregations were welcomed into the Catholic Church. You see, unfortunately, any institution or organization which must be administered by people is subject to their errors of judgment. And this was a terrific one, because he didn't paganize the Christians. He didn't Christianize the pagans, I should say. He just paganized the Christians. The invasions of the so-called barbarian tribes continued heavier and heavier. What the Romans called Ataulfus, of course, the German name Adolf, successor to Alaric as chief of the Visigoths, led the Visigoths out of Italy and into Spain and South Gaul. And even after they settled there, they themselves were overrun by an enormous horde of Suevis, Alans, Vandals, and Burgundians, who largely went on to the south of Spain. Now, you know, of course, there is in Spain a province which we call Andalusia, but the name of it originally was Vandalusia, because that is where the tribe of Vandals settled. Now, when they overran Italy and Rome a while back in that, they showed no respect for the Roman pomp and splendor. Pagan Rome was receiving its judgment at the hands of God, and it was getting a thorough judgment. As pagan Rome had overrun nation after nation with terrific brutality, so pagan Rome was getting a taste of the same thing. And from then until today, they have made vandalism a name for somebody busting things up. But they got it themselves as a well-earned judgment. The Roman legions had been withdrawn from Britain in the year 408 A.D., the last Roman troops taken home in the vain hope of saving Rome. But you remember that in 409 and 410, it was taken by the Visigoths. Now the Vandals, after going through this Visigothic kingdom down to the south of Spain, under their leader Genseric, they crossed over into Africa in 429 A.D. And in the year 434, the Emperor Valentinian formally ceded the province of Africa, that's all of North Africa except Egypt, to Genseric. So here, in the breakup of it, you have the European provinces overrun till Rome couldn't even hold Italy now. She had lost Gaul, she had lost Spain, she had lost North Africa. Genseric built an enormous navy at the seaports on the north coast of Africa, conquered many Mediterranean islands, and harassed the coasts of Italy and Greece. Then, a little after this, there appeared a new scourge, the Huns, under Attila. These were a Mongol people, horsemen. Attila called himself the Scourge of God, and he was interested not merely in conquest and loot, but in utter cruelty, murder, desolation. It was his own boast that the grass never grows again where my horse's hoofs have trod. He ravaged Thrace and Illyria, attacked tribes as far up as the Elbe River and the shores of the Baltic Sea, attacked the Visigoths in Gaul, where the Visigoths finally defeated the Huns with heavy slaughter near Chalons in France.